Welcome to the Wine Scholar Guild podcast. I'm Valerie Caruso, a wine educator and podcast host. And today we're talking with decanter's Andrew Jefford about the Côte d'Or. He also writes for World of Fine Wine and Financial Times. And Andrew is a webinar presenter and immersion trip leader with the Wine Scholar Guild. In fact, you even have some tours coming up in Bourgogne this summer. So before we get into Côte d'Or, did you want to mention those briefly?
Yes, absolutely, Valerie. There's two trips coming up to Burgundy next summer. One of them, I'm afraid, is already sold out. That's the one in June. But we do have some places left for the trip in May, 19th to 24th of May. So if any of your listeners want to get on board for that, hurry along. Look forward to seeing you in Burgundy.
And speaking of, let's talk about the Côte d'Or.
Yes. Well, the Côte d'Or, of course, that's the heart of Burgundy. That's where we spend most of our time when we do these study tours. And, you know, it is still somewhere completely extraordinary in the world of wine. I think we always tend to, because it's so significant in the way we think about the wine world, we tend to forget its uniqueness and its smallness, the way that it nearly doesn't happen. You know, you if you were a kind of seagull flying across France, or a crow or something like that. You had the, you know, the Saône plain with all its, you know, everyday cereal agriculture, if you like. And then suddenly the Côte d'Or happens very quickly, very briefly. And then once you're over that, you're into the hills of Burgundy and we're off to somewhere else as well. It is such a special place. It only happens because you get this particular fillet of angled land, angled to the east and to the south as well. At the edge of the plain, with fantastic soils, where it was discovered 1,000 years or more ago that you could make great wine. Everything comes together just very suddenly and very briefly, and then it's all over afterwards. The other thing about it, of course, is that we're really up at the northern limit for the ripening of Pinot Noir and of Chardonnay. And wherever you get viticulture at the northern limit, every tiny detail counts. It's where terroir really comes into its own. It's really where it really maxes out, if you like. That's why when I wrote the New France book, back in the turn of the century, I spoke about Burgundy as terroir's dreamland. It really is. It's where every nuance counts. It's where the whole of the theory of terroir is explored with the most intricacy. And I guess what I would say to anybody thinking of jumping on one of our tours is, it's only by going there and seeing it with your own eyes that you can really, I think, come to appreciate that fully. So the opportunity to go there is a wonderful one and certainly worth grabbing.
We call it the Côte d'Or. That translates to a golden slope. Is that correct?
The golden slope, yes, because it's angled just perfectly and it's divided up into two halves. Well, they're not exactly halves. One's bigger than the other, but more or less. One is the Côte de Nuit. That's the one further north. Essentially, that's the one that faces absolutely due east and has slightly steeper slopes. And those factors, together with the particular type of limestone it has, means that it's where most of the red wines are grown, the great red wines of Burgundy. And then the Côte de Beaune to the south is angled slightly differently, more southeast rather than due east. It has slightly lower, softer, more undulating slopes and a different mix of soils with, in particular, more white marls rather than reddish limestone soils. And that means that's where the great white Burgundies are made, together with some slightly lighter reds towards the northern end. So both red and white in the Côte de Beaune, which is the bigger of the two Côte.
Okay. And you do have Grand Cru in both. And I think most people think of Côte de Nuit as the place for the red Grand Cru. Like you said, they make both there, but there is a white Grand Cru.
Absolutely. It's a mistake to just see it in two simplistic terms. There are some wonderful red wines made on the Côte d'Or, particularly. I mean, one of my own particular favourites is the Premier Cru wines from Beaune itself. They can be really good. And of course, with villages like Volnay and Pommard, you can have quite deep, stentorian, resonant red wines. And then, of course, up in Corton, you get both colours as well, too. So lots of different things going on. And there are also some white wines up in the Côte de Nuit as well, although not many of those, and they tend to be a little more anecdotal.
Okay. Well, I think it's important that we do distinguish the two, because I think a lot of people think of Burgundy as one wine region or Bourgogne, but it's actually several regions. But this is the one I think a lot of people focus on, is the Côte d'Or. And it is the furthest north, like you said. So, of course, we can't talk about a wine region without talking about climate change.
Absolutely. Yeah.
So when it comes to the world of wine, we can't ignore climate change. So how are we seeing it manifest in Bourgogne, particularly in these northern regions?
Well, you know, one thing that's just happened this year, for example, is that the harvest in Burgundy has begun in August. And it's not just this year. It's the second year running that it's begun in August. And this, you know, in the past would have been completely unthinkable. Harvest was often in October, sometimes the latter half of September. Very rare, and indeed to have it in the early part of September in the past. So that's one absolutely irrefutable fact staring you in the face. The harvests are getting earlier and earlier and earlier. And commensurate with that, you're also getting earlier bud bursts, and you're getting earlier flowering dates as well. So you can definitely measure the effect of climate change in Burgundy. It's like many wine regions, it's a kind of canary in the cage for climate change. What are the effects? Well, you might expect, because it's a northerly region, that it would be a beneficiary region of climate change. And I think, to some extent, what we could say so far is that perhaps that's true, but only perhaps. And I'll explain why only perhaps. One aspect that people sometimes worry about is that, as we've just discussed, it's right up at the northerly limits of Pinot Noir and Chardonnay ripening. That's why the wines have all the finesse and the nuance that they do. And of course, if that ceased to be the case, if it became much easier to get those grapes ripe in this place, the region may lose its edge. It may lose some of that finesse. We're still an awfully long way from that, because there's much more individuation in sites than merely climate, of course. Climate's just one element of it. And even in a warm vintage, a bottle of Village Pouligny doesn't suddenly become identical to a bottle of Puy Fuissé, let alone a bottle of Languedoc Chardonnay. They're still very, very different, and the Burgundy character is still quite transparently there, the Côte d'Or character. But it is a concern. It's something that does worry people. But more, I think, more at the front of people's minds is the whole issue of what we could call wild weather. When you speak to meteorologists about the possible effects of climate change, very often they say, it's not as simple as it's just going to get hotter. The climate is going to become more wild, more unpredictable, more volatile. And that certainly does seem to be happening in Burgundy. There were colossal problems with hail, for example, in 2012, 2013, 2014, 3 years on the trot. And several wine growers in villages like Volnay and Pommard found themselves really reeling on the ropes then, because they got hit 3 years in succession by hail. And of course, there was suddenly frost everywhere in 2016. The harvest in 2016 was slashed by April frosts. And you might think, oh, well, April frost, that sounds cool. Doesn't that just mean that we're exaggerating it all, and in fact, there could be cool years as well as warm years? Well, that would be a sort of primitive reading of the situation, but there are also other more sinister explanations. And for example, a possible explanation for that late frost is that one of the effects of climate change is to melt ice and snow in the Northern Hemisphere, in the Arctic. If you have lots and lots of ice and snow, you get light reflected back out into space. That's called the albedo effect. And we're getting less and less albedo effect in the Arctic. And one effect of that, climate scientists think, is that something called the polar vortex is becoming disrupted in winter. This is a kind of a spinning wind that goes counterclockwise round the Arctic. Very cold, very dense polar air. Normally in winter it's very tight and very well contained. But these warmer winter temperatures that we've been seeing in the oceans towards the northern end of the Northern Hemisphere, and the lack of albedo, seems to be disrupting the polar vortex. And what then happens is you get breakouts of very cold bulges, hernias, if you like, of cold Arctic air pushing south in the springtime. It can happen anywhere right around the Northern Hemisphere. It can happen in Canada, but it can also happen in Europe. And then suddenly you have really cold, frosty, chilly nights at a time when you wouldn't expect them. And moreover, the really terrifying prospect here is that that might also coincide with earlier and earlier bud bursts, which would be a catastrophic combination. So that's another example of the kind of wild, unpredictable weather that's really keeping people awake at night, rather than the idea that Burgundy is suddenly going to turn into South Australia. It won't. That would be many, many centuries away if it was to ever happen. But this kind of disruptive force of climate change is bothering people.
One question to follow up on the climate change question, and I know we hadn't planned to talk about this, but when it comes to these polar vortexes and the albedo effect, and I have to say this is the first time I've ever used those words in a wine podcast, but what are the winemakers doing to combat the hail? I mean, is there an increased use of certain methods of trying to counter the effects of the hail, or the increased use of smudge pots, or any other methods they're using to try to counter the effects of these frosts and hail situations?
Well, the hail situation has been taken very, very seriously by the region as a whole, and they now have a series of stations, weather and hail monitoring stations up in the hills, which include anti-hail cannons. Those are guns that fire up tiny nuclei around which hailstones can seed themselves and form, the idea being that it then creates hailstorms with much less damaging, smaller hailstones in them than might otherwise be the case if the hailstorms form naturally. So that's one thing they're doing on the hail front. And then on the frost front, there was quite a lot of frost threat in 2017 too, but the growers got themselves very, very well organized by going up into the hills and collecting lots of hay bales, which they then lit all around the vineyards to provide a kind of smoke filter that drifted over the vines at the moment at which sun rises, because that's the most damaging moment. It isn't so much the freeze itself, it's the fact that the sun then comes up over the horizon and suddenly begins to warm up the vineyards, and it's the intensity of heat after the cold that causes all of the damage. So it is being taken very, very seriously in the region, and there are, as I say, these elements of a defence underway. It's not guaranteed, it's not 100%, but certainly the anti-frost thing worked pretty well in 2017.
So moving on to the land issues. Now, Bourgogne or Burgundy has some of the most expensive wine property in the world, and the prices don't exactly depreciate in value. So are there any implications for this in the wine world, particularly as climate change and all this volatile weather impacts the region?
Yes. Well, this is something I would say that's worrying growers just about as much as climate change, which is the rise in value of vineyard lands in Burgundy. And it might seem strange to say that growers are actually worried about it, because in principle it's something that they're going to benefit from. But let me just explain how the situation works. I mean, in 2014, Clos de Lambret was sold for a price thought to be around 11.5 million euros a hectare. Bonneau du Martre, Corton Charlemagne, the same kind of price in 2017. Clos d'Etat sold now for apparently over 20 million euros per hectare. And in fact, Grand Cru prices were confirmed last year by the SAFER as being at least 14 million euros per hectare on average. So these are absolutely colossal amounts. It's, when it comes to buying top Grand Cru land, only billionaires need apply. Real Burgundy families are going to lose control of their land if these prices establish themselves and indeed keep rising, because it's very difficult for them to find the taxes required to pass on their land to the next generation at those kind of prices. And if you're trying to build a domain, you can never really borrow money to expand unless you're fabulously wealthy, because the return on capital when you're having to pay those kind of prices for a hectare of Grand Cru land will be many, many decades away. They're really only vineyards that are accessible to people for whom the money almost means nothing, who've got so much that 50 or 100 million euros can be spent without a second thought almost. And of course, this is going to change Burgundy. That there's no question about that. It's going to have a huge effect in the future. And it's something that, many Burgundy families are very worried about, because they feel that they are, as it were, the carriers of the flame, the spirit of the past, the understanding, the intimacy of engagement with the land. And when the billionaires arrive and it all becomes luxury product, they feel that that might be lost.
Now, this isn't a problem unique to Burgundy. We've seen it in Piemonte as well. But the difference, I think, is, well, first of all, I want to know who's buying all this land. But second of all, a lot of these plots were inherited because of the wine laws during the Napoleon. Was it the Napoleonic Code? Was that what caused these plots to be divided up?
Yes, I mean, the Napoleonic Code, in other words, French inheritance law, decrees that every child must inherit equally. You can't decide that everything in your estate is going to go to your eldest son or your youngest daughter. It all has to go to each child equally. So that, in a Catholic country like France, had the effect of dividing properties up considerably with the passing of time. And of course, the more these divisions happen and the more ownership becomes fractured, you know, the more difficult it is to hang on to these kind of domains because, you know, after two or three generations, there may be 20 or 30 shareholders in a property and only one or two of the shareholders actually running the property and actually involved in it day to day. The other 20 or 30, under normal circumstances, won't get a huge amount of annual dividend from the property. Whereas if the land was sold, they can become millionaires overnight. You know, whatever dream it is they have, sail around the world, whatever, they can actually realize it. So it's very difficult to keep everybody on board in a family of perhaps 20 or 30 people under those circumstances. So that is definitely a factor that tends to push domains towards being sold, even if wine growers tend only to have one or two children themselves nowadays rather than, you know, seven or eight as they might have done in the past. As to the question of who's actually buying, well, you know, it is the gazillionaires. It is people like François Pinault, France's second or third richest man. I can't remember which it is. It's Bernard Arnault. It's LVMH, his luxury goods company. Mm-hmm. It is the luxury goods end of things. Stan Kroenke, the American billionaire, the guy who is married to the Walmart heiress, you know, he was the one who bought Bonneau du Matre. That's the kind of people who can play this game and not much anybody else.
So much for owning a vineyard property being that bucolic dream that we all think in the terroir dreamland that you mentioned earlier.
Yep.
But speaking of this land, however, we have terminology that is used quite frequently in Burgundy, such as climat and lieu dit, and I don't think a lot of us really know what the difference is. Can you kind of clarify that a little bit for us?
Sure. And indeed, I have to, you know, fess up at this point that I was pretty hazy about this until relatively recently, so I'm very happy to clear it up. I began to think about it because of, as you know, the Burgundy climat and terroir of Burgundy are now added to the UNESCO World Heritage List. Burgundy was very proud of that. And the way that the UNESCO website in English defines the climat, C-L-I-M-A-T-S, is precisely delimited vineyard parcels on the slopes of the Côte de Nuit and the Côte de Beaune, south of the city of Dijon. So the climat are precisely delimited vineyard parcels. In other words, the names we know, Chambol, Les Amoureuses, Meursault, Genévrière, those kind of things, they're both vineyards, I and climat. Now, I think what's confusing is that when students like those of the Wine Scholar Guild, you know, see a vineyard name on a bottle of Burgundy, which isn't either a Premier Cru or a Grand Cru, it tends to get called a lieu dit. We know those names as lieu dit. There's quite a lot of them in Meursault, for example. And so it's easy from that to assume that a climat is just another Burgundian name for a lieu dit, or perhaps a lieu dit is a name for a vineyard or a climat which isn't either a Premier Cru or a Grand Cru. But it's not. They're absolutely different things, different absolutely in theory, even if not always in practice. I say that because most climats are indeed a single lieu dit. That's true of Chambol Amoureuse. But then if you go next door to Musigny, the Grand Cru Musigny, it is in fact made up of three different lieu dits. There is Les Musigny, there's Les Petits Musigny, and then there's a part of a vineyard called, or a lieu-dit called La Combe d'Orvaux. Echezeaux, a lot of people know that Grand Cru as well. It's in fact made up of 11 different lieu-dits. You can say 10 or 11 because one of them has two different names, so 11 if you regard each name as being separate. And what underlies all of this, the theory, if you like, is that the names and the circumscriptions have different origins. So the climat is the vineyard in Burgundian wine culture, if you like. The word has existed since, I believe, the 16th century, and the notion probably sometime before that. And it's all defined by the Appellation Circumscriptions and the grower's Cahier de Charge, or the rule book. They're the ultimate reference for every climat. The cartographer Sylvain Pithiot calls them organoleptic entities. In other words, they have, in the end, a kind of sensual identity, although he makes a few qualifications there, but that's the idea. Whereas, when you come to Lieudy, they have their origin in France's cadastre, or land register, which was drawn up in the 19th century and is the ultimate reference, as far as the French state is concerned, for all land transactions and taxes. In other words, they're not organoleptic entities like the climat, but they're legal entities, a very different matter. So that's the kind of theoretical difference between them. But they are different things. It's a bit geeky, perhaps. It's a bit techie. But, you know, we are the Wine Scholar Guild, and if we're trying to be wine scholars, we need to know things like that.
And I think that's what makes the Wine Scholar Guild different, is how we get to dive into those things as well. But we have to get to the last question, because all this talk about Lieudy and climat and Grand Cru kind of brings me to you, Andrew. If you were a wine, maybe would you be one of those, or which wine would you be and why?
Okay, well, I'm not going to be a Grand Cru Burgundy, because I'm not worth all the gazillions of euros that they're worth. So no, I'm going to steer clear of Burgundy, in fact. I think if I'm going to be a wine, I'm probably going to be a vintage Searchal Madeira.
Oh.
And why do I say that? Well, because it's very dry, it's very intense, it's not particularly mainstream, but I hope once you've encountered it, it's hard to forget. So I think that's what I'm going to be.
Oh, that's an excellent answer. Andrew, thank you so much for spending some time with us this afternoon.
It was great to be with you, Valerie. Much enjoyed.
Likewise, likewise. And listeners, thank you for joining us for the Wine Scholar Guild podcast. For more information on programs, the Master Lover Bourgogne certification, or immersion trips, visit wineschoolerguild.org.